That's what we sang. We started with about 60 of us. And we marched in and blocked the intersection at 1st and Washington, sat on pads to protect us from the 140-degree pavement. We locked arms and faced outward. The Phoenix police in riot gear marched in on us. They were 200 or 300 strong. But as the swell of officers came within 20 feet, 4 or 5 reporters with camera crews rushed in toward us. They looked for those of us with clergy collars and they stuck microphones in our face. "Are you clergy?" they asked. "Yes." "You are not Latino?" "No." "Why are you here?" "When the law and the people who enforce it are guided by racism and practicing hatred and discrimination, someone has to stand on the side of love." "There are hundreds of officers in riot gear who are going to arrest you. Aren't you afraid?" "Of course I'm afraid. But I'm more afraid of what this country becomes if we let those same officers arrest people because of the color of their skin and perpetuate fear and division. And when parents are taken from their children and deported based on that fear, someone has to stand on the side of love." We were surrounded by people in yellow shirts everywhere. And I knew what that meant, that it meant that we were among Unitarian Universalism, but to the people of Phoenix, it was different. They didn't know what a Unitarian Universalist was. So to them, we were just the love people. We took the corner of 1st and Washington because that's where the Wells Fargo building was, which was where Sheriff Jerry Arpaio had his floor of plush offices. The law, SB 1070, had gone into effect that morning, and Arpaio announced on the news the previous evening that he would be holding massive sweeps of the city to pick up, detain, and deport any undocumented worker that he could find. We wanted to make a point of our own, that xenophobia was not the answer to this country's immigration problems, and those who stood in fear did not stand alone. An hour earlier, organizers had us write the phone numbers of legal services in indelible ink on our bare arms because of the likelihood that when we were arrested, all of our possessions and papers would be taken from us. They made us make sure that we all had outside partners, those people who would do what needed to be done, move our cars, check us out of hotels, hold our cell phones, or call loved ones if we were in jail for a while. "Are you ready?" the organizers asked us. "Wait," came a voice, and it was a man by the name of Jorge Marsuli, who was a Cuban activist for Democracia in Miami. "I just wanted to say," he began, "that I didn't know at first if I really wanted to join you or if I really wanted to get arrested or if even getting arrested would make any difference whatsoever. But when I look around and I see all of the non-Latinos who are here and who are this committed and who are this organized, I know that I have to be part of something greater, and I know I have to be part of what you're doing. And I just wanted to say, thank you." That was our prayer as we marched into the intersection and as we linked arms and held our 100-foot banner that said, "Arizona Human Rights." It kept me grounded for nearly 2 hours, that time which the police began to move in and arrest us. They came up to us one by one, telling us that we were about to be arrested. They said if we did not resist, that they would be gentle. But I knew that police officers had been shot the day before in a drug raid, which heightened the tension. One by one, as they handcuffed us in plastic ties and led us away, we continued to sing. It took 45 minutes for them to get to all of us. But with each person they led away, the chant became fainter and fainter. I was the last person to be arrested. I am placing you under arrest for obstructing a thoroughfare, the officer said. And as I stood up to go with him and stopped singing, that was the end of our chant. And everything fell ominously silent among the 1,000 people who were watching. The officer handcuffed me behind my back and removed my hat and sunglasses and took the scraps of paper out of my pockets and then turned my pockets inside out. I asked him to remove my wedding ring, which he did, and put everything inside my hat and handed them to the contact who had rushed up to me as I was being arrested. When he took us to the transport trucks, I was frisked and they took a Polaroid, which they sealed inside a plastic bag with my citation. The only two possessions that I kept were my non-compliance ID, which contained only my name and my birth date to be in solidarity with those people who could not produce documentation, and my reading glasses. The officer stuck the ID in my shirt pocket and placed the reading glasses on my face before he helped me into the back of the truck, which was lined in steel bars. Jorge Musuli was my paddy wagon partner. They closed the double reinforced doors, which left it very dark and stiflingly hot inside. And with our hands tied behind our back, we had to keep pressing our faces against one another's bodies to keep our glasses from sliding off our face. Maricopa County Jail was only 4 blocks away, but it took 20 minutes to get there because another group of protesters had blocked the jail's entrance. When they finally stopped the car and asked us to get out, we were in the underground garage of the jail and ordered to stand against the wall with the other demonstrators awaiting processing. And as we stood in place, 30 officers in riot gear, including shields and AK-47s, marched past us on their way to the entrance of the garage. The metal door opened and the sound of drums pounding and chanting from outside came rushing in. And one by one, about 20 more handcuffed protesters were led towards us. And although we had an instinct to cheer as they came among us, that urge was stifled by 150 stern-looking officers. And having just witnessed a young Latino prisoner being dragged past us as he screamed desperately, "I am not resisting arrest. I am not resisting arrest." A quiet uneasiness fell over us. From there, we were led 5 at a time through a double steel door where we were hit by a wave of air conditioning and by the chaos of a thoroughly overcrowded booking room. And as we walked in, an officer looked at the t-shirt that I had over my collar, which read, "We will not comply," and he smirked at me. "You're complying now, ain't you?" A thick door with a small window cut into it was unlocked, and it was opened, and instantly 15 other men, mostly Hispanic, looked up as we entered. Their eyes all turned to my collar. "Oh my God, they arrested a priest? Are you really a priest?" "Yes." "What did you do?" I explained, and fellow protesters who were in the cell chimed in. But the Latinos seemed dumbfounded as to why a bunch of white people from all over the country and as far away as Miami would come all this way to get arrested on their behalf, which led to a short explanation of Unitarian Universalism, which no one had ever heard of, and no one could quite figure us out. In that cell, it was hot and stuffy and smelly, and there was one drinking fountain and one toilet in the middle of the open room. The door opened and closed constantly. Names were shouted and people were taken away or dropped off. And at times it seemed like people were moved around almost randomly so as to create a disorientation. And equally disorienting was the fact that In every room that we went into, there were no clocks, there were no windows, there was noise like a TV on static and bright neon lights everywhere. But one thing became surprisingly clear. Every single person who walked in and out of those cells and in and out of our lives for those few hours had a story. And sometimes those stories were told with eyes that revealed shame, and sometimes that revealed remorse, and sometimes anger, and sometimes just confusion or fear. But all of those stories were recognizable. Before this experience, I had always just assumed that there was something undeniable, something striking, something inherent that was different about me than about people who were in jail. And now, after having the experience, I can say that the biggest general observance that I came across of the difference was the color of my skin. Because there was nothing different about our stories, which were all about how our lives had been interrupted from being with the people that we loved, our sense of obligation to remain connected to them, to provide food and housing for our children. The stories were about our sense of desperation, our sense of worry, our sense of unfairness, our sense of feeling powerless. After several hours with my hands cuffed behind my back, my shoulders were getting very sore, and one of the more seasoned inmates came over and gave me some pointers about how I could contort my hands free and recuff them in front of me to help my shoulders. After a couple more hours, I got my first feeling of being forgotten, of being lost in the maze of processing. After I'd been in three or four rooms and nobody was calling my name, eventually, they came in with a nurse who got my medical history and then escorted me to a place where my fingerprints and mugshots were taken. Before they had me stand in front of the camera, the officer who was going to take my picture apologized and told me that he had to remove my collar. He was incredulous when he reached out and grabbed it and discovered that it was just a scrap of white paper plate that I had cut out earlier that morning. "That's all there is to it?" he asked. "That and a whole lot of love," I replied. We were frisked, and our shoes were sent through an X-ray machine, our shoelaces taken. We were told to stand up against the wall, and when I started to ask a question, I was abruptly told to "shut up, prisoner." And it was then that I looked around at a couple of the other protesters that had come in with me and realized that whatever physically distinguishing characteristics we thought we brought in that differentiated us from career prisoners was gone after just about 6 hours. A half a day of incarceration was all it took for us to look exactly like everyone else in jail, which is to possess a look of fear and disorientation. They instructed that absolute stillness and absolute silence was protocol whenever we were outside of our holding cell. And so we were led away and placed in a room with one toilet and three phones. A number of us called the legal services, the number that we had written on our arms, and they took our information. And then I tried to call my wife, Liz. When she answered the phone, a recording interrupted from her end and said, "This is a collect call from the Maricopa County Jail from prisoner Greg Ward. To accept the call, please have your credit card ready and call." And I hung up. And when I called back, I learned that my wife had to authorize a $25 deposit, which lasted about 10 minutes. She told me that everyone had called her, that all three of my outside contacts that legal services, that the UU district executive in the area, and that the TV station all called her. None of them knew whether or not I or anyone with us was eligible for bail. After I hung up, I began to notice that none of the people of color were making any phone calls at all. And when I asked them, they explained that a call from jail was akin to betrayal, since they and their friends and family were mostly doing everything they could to avoid the attention of authorities. An officer unlocked the door holding plastic bags of food, which he tossed in at us. Each bag had two pieces of bread, a small cup of sugary peanut butter, vending machine cookies, and a dried up orange, and a box of Kool-Aid. Sheriff Joe Arpaio prides himself on feeding his prisoners on less than 87 cents a day. "Can we get bail?" someone asked as he dropped out the food. "You're not going to court until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, so get comfy." That's when our collective countenance fell, and the sense of disorientation and separation and contempt that we'd been experiencing all landed and took its toll. And it was very hard not to feel alone or lost or forgotten. I was separated from cellmates and thrown in with new ones every hour or so. And each time I left, I would worry for those who I was leaving, and happy to see or meet those who I was reunited with. I began to feel a sense of solidarity, not only with my fellow protesters, but for everyone in there, those in for armed burglary or aggravated assault or drunken disorderly alike. Everybody's humanness after 8 hours became more important than their charges. This contrasted the collective general fear and contempt that we all began to develop for the prison guards and authority. At one point in the evening, Sheriff Joe Arpaio even came into the jail and walked past our cell, and seeing all the yellow shirts in the tank next to ours, he entered that cell, and it was clear he was there really just to gloat and taunt the protesters. Those in whose cell he entered reported the impulse to flatten themselves against the wall because all of the space was taken up by his enormous ego. I later heard that Arpaio also visited the women who were jailed in a separate section, and the women collectively decided not to speak to him, but to sing to him instead, and they sang, "How could anyone ever tell you you were anything less than beautiful?" And as he stood outside of the door, one of the women made the sign of a heart and pointed at him, and confused, he looked at her, and then he pointed to himself, and then he waved it in a dismissive gesture. We were fingerprinted one more time and taken out of the hall, where we were handcuffed in rows of two with 8 other prisoners, and taken upstairs. There we were told to strip down and put our clothes in a bag, and we were given prison stripes along with pink boxer shorts and pink socks and pink slippers, meant to be humiliating and degrading. And from there we were marched up to cells just big enough to hold 2 people. In these cells was a thin mattress. My cellmate was a young protester attending ASU in Tucson, and he tried to sleep, but he was having a panic attack and hyperventilating, and he used the button on the wall to call the guard over the intercom, saying that he had claustrophobia and general anxiety disorder, and they had taken away his medication. "Well, this isn't supposed to be the Ritz-Carlton," the guard snapped over the intercom, before consenting to come and escort him to medical. And after nearly an hour, he returned in tears, reporting that the nurse just yelled at him and sent him back without his medication. And we talked, and I tried to comfort him, and it was when his anxiety persisted, I suggested we sing. I
I led him through some guided meditation and a little yoga, and eventually we did sleep. In the morning, the doors opened automatically and a guard came by and tossed another identical bag of food that we'd received the night before. Again, handcuffed in rows of 4, 8 total, we marched downstairs to another cell to await our time before the judge. When the door to the courtroom opened, we saw that the women were already inside. When they saw the men being marched into the courtroom in handcuffs, in prison stripes, there was an audible gasp. They were allowed to stay in their street clothes. Eventually, the prosecuting attorney came over to us individually and asked us if we were choosing to plead guilty or not guilty. Confusion ensued, and we all clamored as we thought we would be talking to a lawyer who would be appointed to represent us. And we were told that he was in the jail but unable to enter the courtroom. "Look," said the prosecuting attorney, "we just need to know what you want to plead." And that's when the judge pounded her gavel and ordered silence, or that she would send us all back to our cells and not reconvene until the following Monday. Suddenly, I felt genuinely scared and alone, and thought how possible it was really to get lost. Just then, I heard one of our fellow protesters explaining that there was a plan to delay our plea and hope that the judge would release us on our own recognizance. And when my name was called, the judge called me forward and asked my name and asked if I understood the charges. The prosecutor jumped in and began to argue that I was a transient because I was arrested with my "I will not comply" ID card, which didn't have an address on it, and he recommended $500 bail. The judge just smirked and shouted to the woman scribbling at the table, "PCDROR," which meant that I was released on my own recognizance. I was led back to a room and given back the street clothes and placed in a cell that said "release" in big letters above it. And I felt relief. But I also felt sadness, knowing that I would be leaving people who I knew would be there long after I went home. People who had stood with us and people who had given us courage and people who had kept us from feeling alone. One by one, we were called and led down a hall and put in groups of 5, and I was in the second group. They fingerprinted us again and returned us what they had confiscated on our arrest. And as my group awaited, the first group was led down a corridor into which they disappeared through a door. And a few seconds later, we were all startled when we heard an enormous cheer, several hundred people strong, which erupted from the end of the corridor which that previous group had gone down. Everyone stopped what they were doing, the prisoners, the officers, the staff, and they looked around, and some of them even began to smile. And that's when I had realized that we had not been forgotten. In fact, we had never really been alone. Seeing the smiles among my fellow protesters and among the prisoners and even among the officers and staff, it hit me just how absurd all of this pretense of division and humiliation and contempt and intimidation really was, and yet how real it was. A few seconds later, we were led down that same hall and went through that same door. And when we went through, the cheers erupted again for us. I found out that this group had been waiting outside the jail all night, that they had been singing and praying. And a group of 75 actually watched us from an addendum courtroom on closed circuit TV. And there had been lawyers working with them nonstop to make sure that we made it through the process. When we went through the doors, they shouted, "We love you and thank you," which was an amazing greeting. The next day, when I was still trying to make sense of what had happened and whether it had the power to make any difference whatsoever, the county sheriff's office rearrested Salvador Reza, one of the main organizers of the event. Reza was taken to one of the more painful holding sites, an outdoor facility in the middle of the desert where it often got up to 120 degrees, and that was called Tent City. I was in downtown Phoenix gathering water and other supplies to bring to those standing vigil there. The city was quieter without the protesters and the riot police, and as I walked around the city blocks, local people, mostly Latinos, came up to us and thanked us, and they recognized our Standing on the Side of Love t-shirts, and they knew we were the love people who had come to stand up for them. And a young man came up to me and asked me whether we were planning on taking this protest back to our churches, back to our homes. And that's when I realized that was the real question that I had, that was in my heart, and that was the question that was in our denomination. And that's the question that we've been stuck on. But it remains the question for thousands of people who are still stuck and desperately trying to keep their families together, who provide much of the hard labor this country requires so as we're able to offer low prices on fruit and produce. These are the same people who are arrested every day, detained, tried, convicted, and deported. And they have no one waiting for their release. They have no one waiting to cheer them on or to see them through. When I got back and we were communicating by email and on the web about our experience, one of the respected colleagues on the minister's chat line questioned the purpose and the value of our demonstration. And this colleague referenced a very powerful sermon that she'd once heard a minister deliver and encouraged us to write more sermons instead of going out to demonstrate, because she believed that our protests had little impact and brought more bad publicity than any real positive change. I responded that my time in Phoenix positively changed me, that in 48 hours I learned more about systemic oppression and racism than from a lifetime of attending church or going to seminary. And I told her that I would certainly preach about my experience. But I also said that there was something that I would have to say in that sermon. And that is that during my time in jail, when I was face to face with the pain and the oppression and the brokenness of the system and the people caught in the system, if in that moment, if my colleagues came up to me and asked me whether it would be more helpful to have people waiting faithfully outside the jail for my release or at home writing and listening to sermons petitioning for my freedom, I would take the people every time. Whenever it comes down to a choice between good people and good words, I always take the people. I encourage us all to stand on the side of love and take the people. Take the people.